Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to Resources for the Future. This is our beginning fall series, what we call our first Wednesday series, our special seminars that we have in which we're delighted to have folks participate in. Today we are going to in particular be showcasing expanding work here in the public health arena, which we see as a critical resource to not only Americans but all around the world. We have been in this field for many, many years, but I think we're really seeing a major step up here at RFF. But one reminder from your sponsors, you will see on your seat that we provide you the opportunity to become a friend of First Wednesdays with a pecuniary contribution to RFF. And with that, if you reach a certain level of $100, we will even assure you a seat at these meetings, and as well as you'll get recognized in our annual report. Unlike PBS, our reports are all free, and it's all a public service, so we certainly could offer them as a part of the benefit that you get, but you get that regardless, because that's part of our critical mission here at RFF. Well, this event marks for us the launching of a new center for disease dynamics, economics, and policy, where, among other things, our scholars, led by Ramanan Lakshminarayan, are looking at questions of malaria control and eradication, looking at air pollution for developing countries, looking at effectiveness of antibiotics, looking at detection and reporting of emergency pandemics, which is, of course, part of our discussion here this morning. Leading an institute and initiating this center is Dr. Ramanan Lakshminarayan. Ramanan has done some pathbreaking work here at RFF, and those of you in the health field are quite familiar, I'm sure, with him and with much of his work. On your seat, again, with you are the bios, not only of Ramanan, but of the other panelists here, so we're not going to spend a lot of time on that so we can get to the substance. But I'm very pleased to turn over to Ramanan to moderate and to get from this very distinguished panel, which I want to also say thank you to them for attending today. And as you, those of you who have attended these events before know that after the panelists speak, there will be opportunities for audience engagement. So, Ramana.
Thank you all for coming and participating in this first health event at RFF. So today is also the launch of CDEP in a more official way. But as most of you know, you don't get to launch a center and then start. You have to have done the work of that center for about 5 years before that. And some of that work is in your folder. There's a special issue of Resources Magazine devoted to our work on global health. It summarizes a lot of the work that's done here, malaria treatment strategies and strategies for malaria elimination, antibiotic resistance, incentives for disease surveillance and response, alcohol taxation, value of smoking laws, setting disease control priorities in developing countries, and many more. And there's also a list of publications there. So the question is, why is CDEP launching into this area at RFF, which is traditionally known for environmental and natural resource economics, which is a question that often I'm asked and certainly must come to some of your minds. The truth is RFF has always been involved in health. There's old work here going back to schistosomiasis control back in the 50s and 60s. Health was always the rationale for doing something on the environment in many instances, not for necessarily recreation, but it certainly was the driver of a lot of the valuation that went on environmental issues. So, and some of the earliest work that that happened on air pollution and mortality, the epidemiological work by Lester Lave and Seskin, was from RFF Press. So there's always been a rationale for doing it here, and RFF has never been a static institution. It's always moved. Started primarily on natural resources and materials and energy, moved to environment when that became important, and you know, the work we're doing is to expand that frontier to move into areas that we believe are useful in that they overlap in the way we think about the environment as being more than just, you know, air or water quality. It's also living in areas of malaria. It's living in built environments where you can't, where you don't get a lot of exercise, which might lead to obesity. There's issues of common property and externalities that are inherent in infectious diseases, and certainly also in things like alcohol and tobacco consumption, that share a lot of the features that environmental problems do. So what we're really doing here is pushing out the boundaries of what we think of as being the environment that we live in, to encompass a lot more things that really affect our lives. And certainly there's a lot of room for learning in terms of tools, both from the way we approach environmental economics into health and the other way around. So one of the main goals of CDEP is really to try to dissolve these boundaries. I've never found them meaningful in the sense that I was trained as an environmental economist. I've worked in health for a large part of my career, and I've always thought of them as essentially interchangeable, except the issues were different, but the theory and the methods were exactly the same, and the problems were very similar in many instances. So that's one boundary we're looking to at least blur, because we don't find them meaningful. The other boundary we're trying to blur because we don't find it meaningful is between economics and the natural sciences when it comes to addressing policy questions. Folks at RFF have always worked with scientists. Often they've been on the outside, sometimes on the inside. But we've really spent a lot of time at CDEP building up a cadre of people who work on disease modeling, on epidemiology, on doing the science as well, because it's helpful to have that sort of a multidisciplinary approach when it comes to addressing policy questions, and we feel that we can go a lot further in answering those questions if we were to take that on board here as well. So that's another boundary we're looking to dissolve. Another key goal at CDEP, as for the rest of RFF, is to be useful to policy. In the last few years, we've done work on the Affordable Financing Facility for Malaria, AMFM, on treatment strategies for malaria, all of which have made their way into actual institutions or policies, and certainly on antibiotic resistance as well, and now increasingly on malaria elimination, where some of my colleagues are working with the Ministry of Health in Zanzibar to actually support the malaria elimination campaigns going on there. We're committed to the research, but we're also very focused on the communications through internet and print media. We have a new website, cdep.org. It'll show up later, and a number of our publications are on the outside. So who is at CDEP? It's a lot of, well, RFF is, everyone at RFF is quite young, but our really young people are the engine of CDEP. And as many of you may or may not know, we have about 20 RAs at RFF. And these are the folks who run projects, you know, organize events like this, really make things happen. And, you know, we don't nearly always acknowledge what they do because they're really the ones who make things happen here. Half of those folks, I'm happy to say, are at CDEP. Another innovation is that they're not just in CDEP here today. They're also in Nairobi and New Delhi, where we have expanding offices. And so right here, I want to acknowledge the great work that our research assistants do in everything that we do here and who really make a lot of it possible. So I'd like a round of applause for all the RAs. And if they would stand up, I'd appreciate that. Would all the RAs stand up, please? Thank you. I'm sure there are more watching from their offices. We're indebted to colleagues from our other institutions, some of whom are here today. Martin, Anoop, and Phil are here. Maureen is, of course, now one of our own. But we also have many others, Simon Levin, Ellis McKenzie, Bob Snow, Prabhat Jha, Dean Jameson, Soji Adeyi, Kiran Bihari. These are just some of the people who work with us very closely, almost on a daily basis, on the work that we do and that we share productive collaborations with. And, you know, they've certainly helped create CDEP as well. And, of course, our work is also led on the disease modeling side by David Smith, who, although is at the University of Florida, we have the benefit of having him here pretty much full-time, and we certainly couldn't do much of the work that we do at CDEP without him. So Dave is somewhere here. Dave. And our policy work is led by Helen Gelband, who I hope is here. Helen is shy, so she might not stand up. But Helen leads our Global Antibiotic Resistance Partnership, and certainly, you know, these are the folks who are leading CDEP. I'd really like to thank my colleagues at RFF, both for intellectual collaborations, but also for everything mundane, things like administrative support, things that we mostly take for granted, but which we really depend on, which is why CDEP is at RFF today. And finally, as we all know, money is really the blood that keeps research and activities like ours alive. We've been really fortunate to have strong support from the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, and National Institutes of Health and NSF over the years. They've kept their faith in us and thought that the work that we're doing is worth paying for, so we're very grateful to them as well. So today's event is four speakers. Phil Polgreen, and I'll introduce them all right now so that you can just see them all up one after the other. Phil's at the University of Iowa. He's the only clinician on the panel today. He's one of the most creative thinkers I know. Some of you may have heard of a project to try to predict disease outbreaks using web searches a couple of years ago. One of those two papers was by Phil and his colleagues. He's done amazing other work, including now using social networks like Twitter to try to figure out how people are responding to information about outbreaks. He's going to be talking about the use of electronic markets to help predict pandemic diseases. Anoop Malani is a professor of law at the University of Chicago, is one of the earliest members of CDEP in the sense that he had it up on his website 5 years ago, even before we started, out of sheer faith that one day we would have CDEP. I mean, so I'm particularly delighted that he's here today. Anoop is an expert on many things, including on placebo effects and health economics. He's one of the foremost scholars on law and economics, especially pertaining to health today. And he's going to talk about incentives for countries to report disease outbreaks. The third talk is on how public health agencies respond to swine flu and other disease outbreaks, including potential of H5N1. And so the view from the trenches is really from Martin Meltzer, who's been a close colleague and supporter over the years. We've done a lot of work and lots of interactions together. And one of the reasons I'm really glad that we don't have an outbreak of swine flu yet is because if we had one, Martin wouldn't be here because he'd be responding to that. So I'm delighted for that reason that Martin has been able to make it. And finally, Maureen, who has supported us from a long time ago, especially me personally, connecting me to the public health community when I arrived here as an environmental economist. And fortunately, now she's at RFF and one of our senior fellows, and she's also at the University of Maryland. She's going to be talking about a large-scale modeling project and what you can learn from a project like that in crafting policy responses about when countries might pay for vaccines in other countries and so forth. So each speaker has 10 minutes or less. We'll have time for questions, and we also have, this is being webcast live. For those on the webcast, you can submit questions to sequera@rff.org, and you should have that email address. So, again, that's our website. Thank you all for coming and supporting our work, and this is hopefully the first of many such events on health, and we look forward to seeing you at those as well. Thank you.
Okay, so we were only allowed four slides each, so I'm going to talk a little bit without any slides. My name's Phil, and I'm from Iowa, and I'm going to talk a little bit, tell a story, and show some slides, all in 10 minutes or less. So from a historical perspective, efforts to forecast infectious diseases have been really relatively modest compared to, say, fields like economics, finance, weather, even geology. And one of the reasons is traditional forecasting techniques require long periods of data, and this data has to be updated frequently. And in the case of health, this data is often not available, at least in a reliable and readily available fashion. And so over the last decade, borrowing kind of time series techniques and techniques developed in other fields, investigators in the field of health have tried to use other sources of information. And a lot of these efforts have been called syndromic surveillance, and examples include billing records from emergency rooms, school absentee data, over-the-counter sales of drugs, and more recently, internet searches, looking at how people search for information, health information over the web, and trying to figure out if this gives early indications about new disease outbreaks or at least trends. But I'm not going to talk about any of those today. I'm going to talk about a market approach to gathering and maybe even predicting disease activity. So I'm from Iowa, and Iowa is famous for probably lots of things, but two of the most really it's corn and politics. So corn because we have so much of it, and it's hard to go anywhere without thinking about corn in Iowa or corn prices or the future price of corn. And the other is politics because anybody who wants to be president usually ends up spending a lot of time in Iowa every 4 years. And then they leave and we never see them again. But it was really the research that I'm going to talk about was funded by the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, the Pioneer Portfolio, but it was really inspired by corn and politics because about 20 years ago, two of my colleagues were having lunch, a long lunch, in a bar and talking about politics. And they were talking about political polls and primaries and how polls sometimes really miss the mark. And there had been a couple recent examples back in 1988. And they were talking about how futures markets for agricultural commodities, corn, soybeans, even oil, and that's not an agricultural commodity, but still their futures prices, their prices in these futures markets, and these prices incorporate news very quickly. And for example, oil changes in geopolitical events causes changes in prices very quickly. Changes in weather can change the price of orange juice futures very quickly. And during this discussion, I think it went on a long time, and there were some napkins involved, they decided that they would open a futures market based on who would be the next president or who would win an election. And on this napkin, they wrote down people would buy or sell candidates, shares based on candidates. Would the candidate win or lose? And the prices in these markets would then be a marker, a probability for who would win the election. And that was interesting, but what's even more interesting is that they actually did it. So they opened a market, and for the last 20 years, they've been running markets that involve real money, $5 to $500. They have a no-action letter from the CFTC to run these markets. They didn't the first 2 years, but now they have a letter, and these are allowed to operate. There's a no-action letter, and you can invest money in shares of candidates, and they've outperformed most political polls over the last 20 years. And so I thought I'd show you, since this is Washington and we had a recent election, I'd try to show you some prices that the Iowa electronic market generated. Okay. So according to the market, there really wasn't much of a, you know, uncertainty at all. You can see over time the prices for the kind of the Republican and Democratic candidate didn't matter who would win, just the parties. And you can see very quickly, I don't on this slide, but these changes in prices incorporate new information. I've got examples of presidential debates that change prices. There's an example within 20 minutes of a recent presidential, well, not too recent now, presidential debate where prices changed 20 cents. These markets have been very effective at aggregating information. This is my second slide. This is about the Democratic convention market. And you can see different primaries are listed, and you can see how quickly the price markets, so when people are actually buying and selling shares of candidates, how quickly this information is incorporated into prices. And this is sort of provides a consensus estimate of what will happen in the future. And so I'm not an economist, and I'm not I'm not a political scientist. I'm a clinician, and so I met Forrest and George Newman and Forrest Nelson at a party a couple years ago, and we started talking about flu and infectious diseases. And long story short, we decided to open some seasonal influenza markets in the state of Iowa. And we didn't know whether the CFTC would allow us to actually use the no-action letter, so we decided to give money to people. We invited healthcare workers throughout the state of Iowa, pharmacists, microbiologists, physicians, and infection control professionals, to buy and sell shares based on future influenza activity. Will there be widespread activity? Will there be no activity? 2, 4, 6 weeks in advance. And we gave them each $100. They went to the internet, bought and sold shares, and we used the prices to, with the prices, we were able to anticipate the start, the peak, and the end of the influenza season. We've done that for several years now. And the idea is that there is information out there. It's just that the markets present an opportunity to aggregate that information quickly and efficiently. Microbiologists know there's a disease activity. Pharmacists know, but are actually never even asked. They're not even in any surveillance network, but yet they see people coming in, ordering prescriptions. And so we're just thinking of markets as a way of aggregating information. And these are called prediction markets. Some people call them decision markets or information markets. So our next step was to think about expanding. So with collaboration with a group also funded by Robert Johnson Foundation, the Pioneer Portfolio, with ProMed Mail, which is an electronic mail community of infectious disease experts. There are several thousand around the world. Actually, there are over 45,000 people on the mailing list. We invited people to participate a few years ago in an H5N1 market. And in this market, people could buy and sell contracts that the editorial board at ProMed Mail thought would indicate an increased likelihood of an H5N1 pandemic. And so we had contracts for things like, how many cases will there be in 6 months, human cases? Will there be a case in a new continent? Will certain airports be shut, et cetera, et cetera? And for about 2 years, we opened these markets and had people trade. Again, we gave people small grants of about $100 to use for journal subscriptions or for other purposes when the markets closed. And I've got a price graph here. This particular contract, I could show you others. In this contract, we were asking people to predict, you know, or yes or no, will there be 400 cases? What I'm not showing you is other contracts which talk about, will there be 350 cases or will there be more? And over the period of time, we were able to tell not exactly how many cases there'd be, but roughly there would be more cases, but not too many more. In other words, we were able to bound the number of new cases several months in advance. So if we had more cases, a contract for more cases, the answer very quickly was no, not at all. I'll also add, I didn't show this slide, but during the entire course of the market, we had a contract based on will there be an H5N1 pandemic? Will the World Health Organization raise the threat alert? And throughout the entire period, really, the price of the contract was about 3 to 5 cents. So the consensus view of our participants was that really wouldn't happen. And the slide that I wanted to show would show all sorts of news articles about avian influenza changing over time, but yet the prices for will there be a pandemic just, you know, stable, not going to happen. But something did happen in April, and it's something that we probably couldn't have predicted using a market. Who would have guessed that in Mexico the next pandemic evolved, that it would, you know, it didn't have anything to do with birds or avian creatures. But yet it did. So this time we decided to open another set of markets after we knew within days of the news of the announcement of this market. We started to ask questions like, how many cases will there be in the U.S. within the end of the month? How many states will be involved? How many countries will be involved? And what will the mortality rate be? But this time we didn't even use money. We just had funny money, valueless currency. And I've just got one example, but it shows you sort of how quickly the markets aggregated the consensus view. Within immediately upon opening April 28th, the consensus was that there would be more than 40 states involved. Very few people thought that it would be limited in nature. And that's about the time when there were really only about 2 or 3, maybe 4 confirmed cases in the U.S. So very quickly, and if I showed the mortality slide, very quickly, despite the case that there had been reports of very severe disease in Mexico and several deaths, very quickly, our participants said that the mortality rate would be quite low. And the same with countries. More than 60 countries or 70 countries would be involved within a month. And so I'm out of time. So I guess I just, in conclusion, this is some preliminary evidence to sort of suggest that markets, we knew markets aggregated information quickly, but perhaps decision markets or what we call prediction markets could help aggregate existing information out there and transform it into a usable format for policymakers. Thanks.
I want to thank you, thank Ramanan and CDEP for inviting me to talk. I'm going to talk about a recent paper that Ramanan and I have been working on. And the motivation for this paper is pretty straightforward. We started working on this probably in the midst of concerns about H5N1, not so much about swine flu. And one of the things that we you know, as we're reading the press, we realize, and government policy, we realize, the way that WHO and governments wanted to control H5N1, and true for other diseases as well, is to quickly identify outbreaks, contain them, perhaps with quarantines or prophylaxis, and then later on in the process, we want to add another step to this, which is to quickly sample strains of the virus as soon as there's an outbreak so that we can develop a vaccine. And the one thing we realized was something that was common to all these strategies was the requirement that you immediately identify when there's an outbreak. If you don't catch the outbreak right away, you can't employ quarantines or local quarantines or prophylaxis. You might not be able to develop a vaccine fast enough before the virus spreads. So discovery of the disease is fundamental to control. And both of us are economists, and we realize that discovery is not automatic, that in order to discover disease, people have to tell you about it. And we're not so worried about people who are infected telling us about it. We're worried about whether or not countries would reveal that they actually had an outbreak and tell us, the world community, where that outbreak was. If they didn't do that, we couldn't control the disease. And so we began to think, well, what incentives does a country have to truthfully share information, to surveil, actually, initially, to see if there's an outbreak, and then subsequently disclose that information to the WHO, to its trading partners, to the international community at large, so they can take collective action to stem the spread of the disease, to stop an outbreak from becoming an epidemic. And there are two things that immediately come to your mind, at least came to our mind, was, well, you know, on the plus side, you probably want to report a disease. You, I think yourself as a country, you want to report a disease because you might get medical assistance that'll help you stop the disease from spreading and becoming or the outbreak from spreading and becoming an epidemic, which would kill many people perhaps in your country and, of course, threaten people outside your country. So the main positive motivation is that you might be able to get medical assistance. But there's also a reason why you might not disclose an outbreak, and that is you're concerned that people will stop trading with you, stop visiting your country as tourists. This sort of economic sanction that you might suffer may lead you to think, you know, maybe we just should keep quiet about this. And in fact, at the beginning of previous epidemics, we were concerned about this. There's concerns about early reporting of SARS, and China keeping that hidden, and countries not reporting about H5N1 outbreaks. So, those are the two things that we're really concerned about. And when I talk about sanctions, I'm not even talking about other countries specifically sanctioning a country when they have an outbreak. That seems like kicking somebody when they're down. There's a lot of informal sanctions that go on. You know, if you're thinking about, and by the way, this happened, for example, with me in H1N1 earlier this spring. H1N1 pops up a lot of the activities in Mexico. The U.S. government tries not to sanction Mexico, but I had planned a vacation in Mexico and decided, was wondering whether or not I should cancel that vacation. Many of you probably may have altered your travel plans in response to H1N1. So that's an example of informal sanctions that can occur. People just reduce their demand for the goods or services produced by a country that reports that they have an outbreak. So we were concerned about that also being a negative effect. And we had good reason to worry. Earlier this spring, we were also looking at reporting of meningitis cases. And meningitis cases, and so this is adult meningitis, meningococcal disease. It's a disease that affects Africa, predominantly, particularly a belt called the meningitis belt in the middle of Africa. And we are looking at these data that suggest that there was this massive drop in the number of meningococcal disease reports, or a number of countries reporting meningococcal disease outbreaks in the mid-1980s. And you know, maybe that was just a dramatic improvement in the rates of meningococcal disease, but we thought that maybe there was something else going on. And so we had this graph that illustrated the problem. So if you look at the blue line is the number of, if I have this correct, it's the number of countries over time that are reporting outbreaks of meningococcal disease. So on the x-axis, you've got years that go back, I believe, from 1960 all the way to basically 2000. And on the left-hand side are counts of countries. On the y-axis, you have counts of countries. And you see about two-thirds of the way across the slide where there's this peak tagged by a note, you start seeing a dramatic plummeting in the number of meningococcal cases, countries reporting meningococcal outbreaks. And then about 10 years later, that the number returns. You start seeing a lot more reporting. You might think, as I said, that maybe just disease rates had fallen, but we thought otherwise. We thought, you know, what happened in 1987 that changed people's incentives to report? And the one thing that we figured out was that in 1987, so a lot of people from Muslim countries visit Saudi Arabia to conduct the Hajj pilgrimage. And one of the problems with the Hajj pilgrimage is that you have meningococcal outbreaks, meningococcal disease outbreaks. In 1987, there was a particularly bad one, and Saudi Arabia responded by trying to impose immigration restrictions on countries that had outbreaks. They also required vaccines and such, but their initial response was to reduce, to stop giving visas to people that came from countries that reported outbreaks. So quite naturally, you might suspect that countries with large Muslim populations would suppress reports of outbreaks because for fear that their citizens wouldn't be able to go to the Hajj, which would, might generate some domestic political instability. And in fact, you see that sort of behavior. And it only stops, quite not surprising to us, when an international organization called the ICG, organized by the WHO, started subsidizing vaccines for countries in the meningococcal belt to reduce the number of outbreaks, or at least convince Saudi Arabia that this country is getting vaccinated, you can let them in despite the presence of an outbreak. And so that you see a return to reporting. And so our hypothesis when we saw this was that this drop had nothing to do with the real biology of disease. This had to do with reporting. A sanction from Saudi Arabia discouraged reporting, and that it was a subsidy, medical assistance, basically, that encouraged reporting to return. So we decided we would model this using game theoretic models, specifically a signaling model. Thought you'd remove that slide. But without going into the details of the model too much, we basically thought, let's think about countries that surveil for disease as having received some sort of information, private information about whether or not they have disease. And they have to decide whether to report it to the rest of the world. They have to send that signal, I have an outbreak or I don't have an outbreak. And then we think about why they would or why they wouldn't. And then think about how other countries would set their trade levels in response to that. So it was a full signaling model. And we found three major lessons. So the first thing is, I said sanctions should in general discourage a country, from reporting its disease, but that's not always true. And the reason is because your trading partners don't just limit their trade with you when you report an outbreak, formally report an outbreak. They'll also limit their trade with you when they fear that you have an outbreak that you're not reporting. Okay? So for example, if you think Indonesia has H5N1 cases that it's not reporting, you may limit your trade with Indonesia, your demand for Indonesian goods or services, even though they haven't formally reported an outbreak. Okay? Now, that sort of sanction is actually a good thing, because then when Indonesia thinks, should I actually report an outbreak, they say, well, even if I don't report, I'm going to suffer a loss of trade. So the harm from actually reporting is a little bit lower. So these sanctions based on fears of an outbreak, of unreported outbreaks, actually encourage reporting when there is an outbreak. So that was a little bit counterintuitive. Here's the second thing, and I think this was the thing that really surprised us. When you look at the surveillance community, or the international community, think about how we should track H5N1 or H1N1, we think it's really, really important to have great technology that identifies who has the disease and who doesn't have the disease. We want to have really good diagnostic testing. It turns out diagnostic testing may not be, or better diagnostic testing may not be a boon. And here's the reason why. The information that we have is the result of two things. Information we, the community, world community, have is a result of two things. One is the results of the test, and the second is whether that test is reported to us. Getting better tests will improve your chances of detecting actual outbreaks when they actually occur, but they may change people's incentives to report that information. If it reduces people's incentive to report that information, the net amount of information received may actually be lower. And so here's the way to think about whether or not a country that is given a more accurate test or develops a more accurate test will actually use that to report more or less. On the one hand, a more accurate test gives you better benefits of reporting. You know for sure somebody that I found that tested positive for an outbreak of H1N1 actually has H1N1 or so on. But the flip side is that your trading partners also know that when you report that you have disease, you probably really do. That it's very, very high predictive value. So they might actually sanction you even more. So you're getting both. You're getting more valuable medical assistance and expectation, but you're also getting more severe sanctions. And it's quite possible that the sanctions can outweigh the medical benefits. And so you might actually decrease the amount of outbreaks you report if you actually have access to more advanced diagnostics. So diagnostics don't necessarily improve matters. And the last thing I want to add is that there's a lot of surveillance that we do is not based on official reports by countries. A lot of it's based on informal surveillance. We hear about rumors. We find reports on political websites. We hear from doctors that have emigrated out of countries, things like that. We look at indirect data, such as the stuff that Phil was talking about. And the question is that a good idea or a bad idea? And we actually find in general, it's got some of the same problems as more accurate testing. And in fact, it's just another way to improve accuracy of testing. But it's got some benefits. And the benefits are correcting errors in diagnostic testing by countries that are reporting outbreaks. If a country reports an outbreak when there really is an outbreak because of false positives, the informal network, rumors, can correct that. If they fail to report something when there actually is one, the rumor can correct that. And what that does is that reduces the amount of sanctions that countries face when they report a false positive and increases the sanctions that countries face when they report a false or when they fail to report a disease when there actually is one. That's a false negative. That change in alignment of sanctions actually encourages countries to report diseases more truthfully. So I'm out of time, so I want to stop. But these are some interesting, not obvious implications that result when you think about incentives for reporting separately from just science about reporting.
Good afternoon. My name is Martin Meltzer from the CDC, Senior Health Economist. I've been there about 15 years. And virtually for the entire time there, I've been working on issues related to planning for the next influenza pandemic. And guess what? It's arrived. So when Ramanan asked me to talk, he said four slides, so I promptly ignored that. First rule you learn is ignore what Ramanan says. At least when it comes to talks, because you notice he talks more than four slides. So what do my colleagues and what do policymakers want in the trenches when it comes to predicting or planning and preparing for the next influenza pandemic? And do understand that as the pandemic unfolds, you don't stop planning. You always have to plan for next day or next week. What about vaccine distribution? Who should get it? How do we treat reports of potential vaccine-related adverse events? And here's some data that we produced some years ago as part of the official U.S. Department of Health and Human Services official pandemic plan, looking at a 68 and a 1918 type pandemic. And of course, what we have at the moment, what we're going to probably experience, will be nothing like this, fortunately. Here's somebody else's version of what could happen. And you notice I draw your attention to the number at the bottom, 1 billion dead. I guess when you write a popular book that you buy at the airport, you don't have to put in your sources or methods. It's great. What is missing, obviously, from any, and I mean any, predictions or estimates or illustrations of potential impact is what's the likelihood of a given estimate or illustration actually occurring? And I'm here to tell you, my crystal ball is as good as yours. They're all painted black. And many of the times when you see these so-called experts on TV or in the media, they forget to differentiate between what's possible and what's the probability. We do know about flu. It's always helpful when you're thinking about the probability of a given event occurring and the magnitude of that event to consider the enemy. And we know that flu is highly variable, both seasonal type flus and pandemic flus. And here, for example, we have the same strains, different years, and an 10 times difference in terms of deaths estimated. We also know, even amongst high-risk and non-high-risk, for example, this data is 20 years. It's one of the longest data series that I know of in this particular case. These are young kids, and this is the hospitalizations per 1,000 for this age group. It comes from Tennessee, this data. This is not regular and routine. Every year is different. Same with pandemics. Every pandemic is different. And again, you probably know of this one. In 1918, very famously, very different case fatality curve. They had the famous W. For some reason, not still fully understood, though there's lots of interesting theories out there, adults, most of them healthy in the ages somewhere around 25 through 35, 40 years of age, had death rates much higher than we'd see normally in influenza. What people forget, even in 1918, of course, is that elder people and the younger people had case fatality rates equal or greater than the those in that age group. So what we really should understand when we're trying to predict what is flu, and people ask me, what's the impact going to be of this H1N1 influenza pandemic, because that'll help us decide who to vaccinate, how much to vaccinate, how much effort, what kind of messaging we should have. We always have to remember that the impact varies greatly every year, and as we can see this time, by every pandemic. By age, and as we know in this pandemic at the moment, today, there seems to be a signal saying that people over 60 just aren't falling ill at the rates we expected. They do get ill, and when they do get ill, they have some of the highest rates of hospitalization, but they're just not getting ill in the numbers we previously thought, even based on previous pandemics. There is a difference between those with pre-existing high-risk conditions and non-high-risk conditions, and that has still been seen in this pandemic. And as we talk about differences in age groups, man, it changes from every pandemic. You just can't say this age group will always be at the highest risk. A quick evaluation summary of previous pandemics. It's always a good idea to look at history, but never let history entirely guide your thoughts and understanding of what's going to happen. And just to get some idea, normally in the interpandemic period, we talk about an average of 36,000 deaths every year. That's an estimate. And around 220,000 hospitalizations. What's different to date is that in normal seasonal flu, these 36,000 deaths, 95% of them are in people over 65, and we know who they are. They typically have one or more pre-existing medical conditions. They're very frail, and the onslaught of infection and disease from flu is essentially the last straw. In this pandemic, as I mentioned, very few people over 60 are becoming clinically ill. It's like the iceberg is turned upside down. And the deaths and the hospitalization are occurring in groups that, yes, normal season deaths and hospitalizations occur in children, but probably not at the rates, that we think we might experience here in the U.S. What does a pandemic swine flu, I'm allowed to say that word, probably not, hope pork producers not yet, look like? Well, what we experienced some outbreaks in the spring, but what we saw in the spring was by no stretch of the imagination a pandemic across the whole country. There were more localized outbreaks in certain metro areas, there are large chunks of the country. Yes, every state had outbreaks, had cases, but not large ones. It's more isolated, and it was not the pattern of a widespread pandemic. In the southern hemisphere, though, where they act as something of a guinea pig for us because they don't have influenza vaccine, though they do have influenza antiviral drugs, we can see from Australia the pattern of influenza-like illnesses to the physicians. So what percentage of physician visits, or what number of physician visits, are for influenza-like illnesses? Now, that doesn't mean to say that every of these visits is for flu. Influenza-like illness can be caused by a number of respiratory pathogens. But what we see here, the dark black line is this winter in Australia, the impact of 2009 H1N1. And we can see, in fact, really not much difference. They are not shown on this graph, but we can imagine the accuracy of reporting and measurement, probably rather wide confidence intervals, not much different from 2007, which was an H3 year, not an H1. And H3 tends to be more severe, in fact, in terms of outcome and impact. So we also see from here, if you say it about 10 per 1,000, get above that threshold, a lot of flu circulating. We see what we have about week 20 through week 37, somewhere between a 16 and 20-week duration so far. What we don't know, and this is the part I'm really watching, is there going to be a second bounce? And that's really important, particularly in reasons to vaccinate. They, of course, didn't have the vaccine to vaccinate. So one of the questions is, as Australia can get vaccine into October, November, December, is it worthwhile vaccinating with a monovalent H1N1? And that answer really depends, is that going to go up again because it starts to recirculate? Here's some examples of estimates of potential impact on deaths, and everybody's interested in deaths, and our friends in the media always like to report how many are going to be dying. Seems to excite them. What we've got here is something very different than in a 1968 pandemic, if a 1968 pandemic were to hit. This graph shows what would happen if a 1968 pandemic would hit. What we're probably going to see is something down here. Fortunate. This is a good thing. But unlike in 68, as I said before, the vast majority of deaths are not going to be people over 60 for the simple reason that people over 60 are not becoming clinically ill. Also, and this is true with similar pandemics and even in non-pandemic years, what we are seeing is that the vast majority of cases that are hospitalized and dying are those with pre-existing medical conditions. And you can literally talk about 70-80% of deaths and hospitalizations probably going to be amongst those with pre-existing high-risk conditions. We know who these people are. Some data from the spring 2009 in the U.S., and do remember, we did not have a pandemic. We had a foretaste. It was the seeding of our population, not a full-blown pandemic. Attack rates were very localized in the spring, and what we would expect into the fall and winter is that become very unlocalized, widespread. Hospitalizations, as I mentioned, children, about 60% of those hospitalized had high-risk conditions. Adults, about 80%, and about 20% of those hospitalized spent some time in the ICU. That 20%, by the way, is pretty much, and this data are actually quite hard to find, but in seasonal influenza, we always say as a rule of thumb, 15 to 20% of those hospitalized with flu will spend some time in an ICU, intensive care unit. I am here to tell you that we cannot report on a weekly basis the exact numbers of those hospitalized or dying or even certainly not cases of H1N1, and the reason is that we do not test routinely, nor do we encourage hospitals to test and physicians to test. One reason is that we found in the spring very rapidly that the confirmatory labs were overwhelmed. So we are and in many cases, from a clinical point of view, once you admit somebody to a hospital with a respiratory disease, you're going to start a clinical course of action. And quite frankly, the test results aren't going to alter that clinical course. So there's very limited value. And our testing laboratories with a limited capacity have other priorities, such as checking for the rise or appearance of resistance to influenza antiviral drugs and changes in the genetic structure that would indicate greater or reducing severity of illness. I can tell you that what I have seen of the data reminds me very much of what occurred in 68 in terms of the lower estimates. Not exactly, but I can also tell you that somewhere between half and double of that is what we see. Once somebody gets ill, what's the probability of them dying? It looks like this. Not these numbers. These numbers. The big question then becomes, how many thousand cases? What will be the attack rate? We will not see this, thank goodness. And there are a few tools, and we are hoping to, as soon as I can get them cleared, to put up on the web updated versions that will have be populated with H1N1 specific data. Thank you.
Okay, well, this is all going up. Let me say that what I'm going to say today, which is about really the value of collective action in mitigating the impacts of an international pandemic, is based on a project that was funded by the World Bank. It's joint with many co-authors, one of whom, Mead Over, is here in the audience from the Center of Global Development. The question I'm going to focus on in the 10 minutes is, what are the benefits of rich countries donating stocks of antivirals to poor countries in the event of a pandemic? And the perspective here is that it's going to be very hard to actually contain a pandemic at the source, given the fact that the pandemic is going to spread rapidly through the air transport network, and depending especially on how infectious the strain is. Let's assume that the goal is really to mitigate the effects of the pandemic and, in fact, to try to push it off in time, to try to buy time by reducing the gross attack rate, the percentage of people who are infected at the end of the first year. And so I'm going to focus on antivirals as a way of doing this and giving infectious people antivirals. And the question I'm going to focus on is, in a world where, let's say, rich countries, these are going to be countries with per capita GDP of $20,000 a year or more, have at least stocks of antivirals sufficient to treat at least 10% of their populations. Okay, in that situation, what would be the benefits of rich countries donating 10% of their stocks to the outbreak country, the country where the flu starts? And by benefits, I mean, what is this going to do to the attack rate in the outbreak country, in the donor countries, and also the world as a whole? Another question that's of interest is, suppose that, let's say, WHO developed a large stockpile and it gave the stockpile to the country where the flu starts, the outbreak country. Suppose that rich countries then donate some percentage of their stockpiles to many poor countries as the outbreak progresses. Okay, as the flu progresses. So this is really a more broad-based strategy where rich countries are donating to a larger set of poor countries, and I'm assuming that the flu is likely perhaps to start in a poor country. And finally, the question that we were in some sense asked to ask by the bank was, are the benefits of these actions to rich countries, the reduction in the gross attack rate in the rich country, are these actually sufficient to justify these actions just on selfish grounds? I mean, obviously, there are altruistic reasons for donating these stockpiles, but will doing this actually reduce the attack rate enough in rich countries to make this selfishly worthwhile? Okay. In order to answer this question, you really need a model of the spread of the flu through the air transport network throughout the world and also using road-based travel. There are perhaps half a dozen of these models operating in the world now. We have developed one of them. Victoria Kalitsa and colleagues have developed another, and we don't have time to talk about all of the different models. But the answer in terms of how effective cooperative action in terms of this antiviral strategy is going to depend on three factors. The first is how infectious is the flu? This is usually described by what epidemiologists call R0, the number of people that an infected person will infect in a totally susceptible population. For seasonal flu, this is usually between 1.3 and 3 people. And we just heard about the 1968 flu, where it was estimated to be about 1.9. It's been estimated to be about 1.5 for H1N1. And in the second wave of the Spanish flu, it probably got up in some places to 3. The higher the R0 is, the faster the epidemic is going to take place and the harder it's going to be to control. So any AAV control strategy will be more successful the lower is the R0, and this is going to affect the benefits of cooperation. It also matters when and where the flu begins, because the flu is going to be much milder worldwide if it peaks in the Northern Hemisphere's summer. Okay, most of the world's population lives in the Northern Hemisphere. If it peaks during the non-flu season in the Northern Hemisphere, it's going to be a much milder flu. So it does matter where it starts. You're going to see results in a moment for a flu that starts in Indonesia in January, so it would actually be peaking in the summer. It's going to be worse if it peaks during the flu season. In terms of the effectiveness of controls, again, they will work better if you have a situation where the flu is peaking in the summer in the Northern Hemisphere. And it also depends on the kinds of how fast, basically, you can administer antivirals and to whom. Generally speaking, not everybody's going to be symptomatic. People who are symptomatic can be treated in the model. The question is, what percentage of symptomatic people can you reach, especially in developing countries? Can you reach half of them, 70% of them? We're assuming, in the results you're going to see now, 60%, but you vary this, and it affects very much the benefits of cooperation. And it also depends on how fast you are able to give somebody a course of Tamiflu once they go from an exposed to an infectious state. If you can do it on the first day that they exhibit symptoms, boy, it really has a much bigger impact. So these are going to really affect the results here. So think about this scenario. Suppose the flu does start in Indonesia on the 1st of January, and we're thinking of a fairly severe case here where the R0 is 1.9. And let's assume that rich countries with over $20,000 per person in GDP, these are market exchange rate numbers, have stockpiles that will cover 10% of their population. For countries in the next income group, and by the way, about between 900 million and a billion people in the world are in that first group. In the second group, which is about 500 million people, are in the next group. Let's assume that in countries that would include China, where you've got income between $300,000 and $10,000 per person, that you've got really small stockpiles. There are about a little over 2 billion people in that group. And then the rest of the world, 2.8 billion, really poor people have no stockpiles. Suppose you can treat 60% of symptomatic people on the second day that they're infected. And once there are 1,000 cases detected in a country, that's when you're going to begin the treatment. If you look at the implications of that scenario, after 1 year, at the end of this first year, when hopefully people have been developing a matched vaccine, the world gross attack rate is about 40%. And in rich countries, it's about 27%. Okay. What are the benefits of cooperation? I have 1 minute. Okay. I will just end with this slot. I'll try to do this pretty fast. Okay. Suppose rich countries donate 10% of their stockpiles to Indonesia, which is going to be about a little over 9 million doses. The world gross attack rate in percentage terms, doesn't decline a whole lot by the end of the first year, by 0.7%, but that's 45 million fewer cases. But the question here is, you know, what is this doing to rich countries? Well, their gross attack rate goes down by a little more percentage-wise, by 0.73%. 6.7 million cases fewer are being experienced. Does it pay for itself? Well, if you think every avoided case is worth about 1 1/3 times the cost of a dose, you're giving 9 million doses to get 6.7 million fewer cases, the answer would be yes. But are these results really robust? And the answer is not really. They depend a lot on the size of R0. You actually save more people when you have a lower R0, but at the same time, you're also going to save fewer people in rich countries. Nonetheless, it looks like it would pay. But everything changes very much depending on the start date. The seasonality matters a lot here. And it also matters about how large the stockpiles are to begin with in the high-income countries, because the higher those are, the lower the attack rates in the first place and the smaller the benefits of these externalities from lowering the rate of infection in other countries. Since I do have to stop here, all I'm going to say is these results, which are only a very small part of our project, obviously don't imply that you don't want to do a strategy like this just because it doesn't pay for itself in terms of rich countries. But I think it's really important in actually determining the effectiveness of a strategy like this to look at realistic assumptions about how fast you can actually deliver something like an antiviral stockpile. So I will stop there.
So that was an excellent set of talks and certainly a topic that we can spend more than an hour on. Time for some questions, and Griffin has a microphone there, so if you can raise your hand to ask a question right here, and at the back, Bill Blaine. Yeah, please speak directly into the microphone because the presentation is being recorded and being webcast.
Andre LaPrairie, Public Health Agency of Canada. Thanks very much for all the talks. I especially like the last one on the economics of antivirals, although I think it might have been more interesting if you did a study on the economics of vaccinations. It's for flu, I guess it's about a $4 billion worldwide cost a year, but it's one that you have to do every year. It's kind of like the grocer that has to pay the mafia every year for protection, but you know, the risk never goes away. So it might be worthwhile to look at, is this really a good economic solution to the flu? And if it is, are there benefits if the strategy was more international rather than national? Because right now you have individual countries each determining what their flu dose or formula is going to be. And of course, the shelf life of that vaccination is very limited because the flu keeps changing. So that I don't know whether you have any comments on that or...
Okay. Marie?
Yes, I was going to say, actually, the colleagues, other colleagues in this group have done work on the benefits of vaccine stockpiles. I mean, of course, those are rather different than what we're talking about here because, generally speaking, you're going to be giving that to everybody in the population. This you're targeting only at infectious people. I don't want to speak, I guess, really for other members of the group, but they did look at the impact of having a large vaccine stockpile of something like 50 million courses that didn't seem to do a whole lot. I mean, in terms of a cost-benefit analysis of something of basically a seasonal flu vaccine and what it's going to do to stop the spread of a pandemic, we really haven't done that analysis at this point. But it's a very, very good question.
Bill?
Dr. William Bain, the Agency for Healthcare Research and Quality. I'd like to ask Dr. Polgreen about his slide for the 400 cases, why it isn't bilaterally symmetrical about February of that year. When you had your Democrat versus Republican, you could have a line, horizontal line through the slides, and it was symmetrical above and below that, but you didn't have symmetry for one part of your pair.
So are you the two curves, one curve was yes and one was no?
Right.
And those are average prices over a week? or maybe they're flipped. So are you wondering what caused the change?
No, I'm wondering why the there wasn't as big a rise in the, I can't remember if it was the no's or the yes's, as it was a fall in the opposite group.
I guess it depends on, I mean, I'd have to look at the underlying data, but...
For all of the rest of the slide, and for your slide with the Democrat versus Republican presidential winner, there was a bilateral symmetry.
Right. Yeah, it happens to do with kind of who's buying contracts of what, but also it has to do with kind of trading volume and how thin the market is at that point. With the presidential markets, those are very active, and people are trading every minute almost at some point. The bid and ask queues are very, very active. And that wasn't really true with some of our infectious disease markets. So people would trade maybe on a weekly basis. We'd send out an email for all of our infectious disease markets. We'd send an email out about every week, and then people would trade or not trade. So
I guess the markets are pretty thin for these.
Right. And that was not as true with the H1N1 markets were much the trading volume was greater, and certainly with H5N1, the trading did die off after when we first opened the markets. There was quite a bit of interest and anxiety. There still was, but certainly 6 months, 12 months into the project, there wasn't as much interest, and hence there wasn't as much trading. Really wasn't as much new information that was resolving, just a slow trickle of cases.
Right. Probably would add that there seems to be also a bit of discomfort with using trading for these sorts of things, which there's obviously been pushback from economists who find this very useful and interesting. But recall, you know, after the terrorism attacks, someone wanted to open a trading market to predict terrorist outbreaks, and there were concerns that that might not be ethical. So, I mean, are those pretty much the roadblocks to having this be done with more than just funny money, that you can do it with real money at some point?
I think most of the – so those markets were funded by DARPA, and that project stopped because of political concerns. There were some the ideas for sort of to use these markets in the intelligence community, and those projects stopped. I think most of the barriers are really to using real money, which would be the easiest if people could invest their own money, really are legal at this point. There's a letter about a year and a half ago in Science that was signed by four Nobel laureates asking the CFTC to relook or re-examine how they look at markets and the use of prediction markets in educational settings, and trying to get the regulatory agencies to allow universities and other research groups to open small-scale markets using a limited amount of money to be able to run markets for research purposes. But I think that a lot of other stuff happened in this fall, and that might have dropped off the kind of CFTC radar. There are a lot of other issues.
On the mind. Lady in red.
Yes, I have a quick question.
Could you identify?
My name is Christina McLaughlin. I'm with the FDA. Regarding the benefits of donating antivirals to other countries, I'm wondering if you had hit an important point on the effectiveness of the program would depend a lot on three things, and you talked about the administrative, how the antiviral is distributed in these countries. And I grew up in Bolivia for 11 years, and what I've seen with medicines donated to this country is that they disappeared and they were being sold. And so, you eliminate 10% or a certain important amount of this antiviral for our own use, but wouldn't it make more sense to give them the cash to buy the antiviral if they wanted to? Because they're going to use it for something else, like selling it. And so it promotes kind of an adverse selection situation that, you know, doesn't seem to give an optimal result.
Well, you're actually raising two good questions. I mean, one question is, why does it have to come out? Why does the total stockpile have to be fixed? Obviously, we could expand it, and so what would be the cost and the benefits of the margin of doing that, which we are looking at, but in 10 minutes you can't get into everything. And the other question, though, is really this issue of how would the actual donation be given, but also in terms of priorities. I mean, the larger question really, I think, should be in terms of promoting better health in a poor country, do you want to do it in this way? Is reducing the attack rate from the flu the best way to go, or is it to put the money somewhere else? So I think that's a really important broader question that we are not addressing in this project.
Question at the back there, and then in front.
Hi, my name is Jeremy. I'm an intern at the Project for Emerging Nanotechnologies at the Wilson Center. This is sort of on a related note, but I was wondering if any of you could touch upon what the economic repercussions of antibiotic resistance would be. Any thoughts on that?
Anu?
Yeah. So I think there are two consequences. One is that a lot of times flu generates secondary infections. It's an issue with H1N1 as well. People that otherwise would have been saved where they're not resistant might not be saved because of resistance. So that's the direct cost of currently having resistance. But I think that there's a secondary issue floating in the background, which is if we don't control flu, we don't prevent flu, and there are a lot of flu cases, those will generate secondary infections, which will generate demand for antibiotics, which down the road will lead to greater resistance. And so we'll see higher levels of resistance, which won't then come back and interact with flu, but will create a problem generally for medicine, because a great deal of medical treatments rely on having antibiotics to control infections. When you do surgery, you want to have prophylactic antibiotics to make sure that there's no infection at the site of the surgery. So if we don't have effective antibiotics at that point, then the surgery becomes less valuable or less likely to save you. So I think it'll have a general impact on the quality of medicine, the effectiveness of medicine.
Phil, did you want to add something?
So it is true that flu can sometimes predispose people to secondary bacterial infections. It does happen, but it's really probably less than 15 or 10% of the time. However, flu, even seasonal flu, does generate a lot of antibiotic use that's probably inappropriate. And that happens every year. So controlling influenza, I think, will control the use of antibiotics. And certainly seasonal antibiotic use is extremely seasonal, and a lot of that is probably due to the flu.
Well, Phil and I have a study underway which is looking at influenza and antibiotic prescription, and obviously it's amazing how bang on, you know, influenza cases predict antibiotic use. But I think a broader issue in what you're talking about is also about the role of antibiotics in influenza preparedness, which doesn't nearly get that much attention. Everyone's talking about Tamiflu stockpiles or vaccines. The most recent numbers from the Morbidity and Mortality Weekly Report from CDC, I guess last week, showed a large number of, at least about a third of the swine flu cases had secondary bacterial infections. And certainly we've thought for a while that perhaps we should start thinking about how antibiotics should be part of the response, just in terms of dealing with flu pandemics. But we haven't seen very much in terms of that being part of the actual pandemic preparedness plans. So maybe there are others in the room who know more about this than we do. But question in front.
Yes. My name is Claire Narod. I'm from the International Food Policy Research Institute. And my question has to do with the talk on the game theory. It seemed to me that a lot of what you were talking about was how countries reacted or the incentive of a country to report. But the work we're working on avian flu also and working on issues associated with production and animals. And it seems to me that its individual behavior actually is interlinked to the ability for a country to be able to report. And I'm wondering what we're finding is the individual behavior to alter. It's not just about knowledge that gets people to alter behavior. There's attitude, there's perceptions, there are other types of risk trade-offs that they're interested in. And I'm wondering if you're trying at all to look at that, bring the individual behavior to the country-level behavior in terms of reporting, because if the individuals can't report or if there's not good surveillance mechanisms or detection mechanisms up there, that would be hard for the country to report.
No, I think that's very important. In the paper that we wrote, we generalized from vagaries of individual behavior, but for practical purposes, we cannot do that. There are important issues about whether or not people realize they have an infection, that it is the flu as opposed to something else, whether they actually have access to treatment. And they have to feel comfortable sharing that with the government. If they just hide it and keep it within their local community, then, of course, the government never has the opportunity to report to the worldwide community. So the short answer is I think we do want to focus on those sorts of things. I think it's a little bit more complicated. We might think very simplistic about countries' incentives. They care about the lives of their population. They care about overall trade. But individuals have a lot of other things going on. They have different risk preferences, which you've indicated. I think norms are a very important component of this. There are some societies where it's okay to share that information. Other societies where medical information or sickness is kept a little bit more quiet. And you have to pay attention to that. So you might have a lot of different responses depending on where you are in the world and what kind of community you're part of.
Great. One last question from here.
Hi, Rebecca Katz from George Washington University and also the Department of State. This is actually also on the predictive models. And very interested in the work and wondering if you were able to specifically capture the impact of the international obligations under the international health regulations to report certain public health emergencies of international concern. And if there was a way to actually pull that out in looking at country behavior, but also the fact that I think between 60% and 80% of all reports under the IHRs are coming from non-governmental organizations to the WHO, and then the WHO can then ping back the country. And if that also is, if you're able to capture that in the model.
Yeah, so first I have to say that when we first looked at this, we were concerned about, and actually partly motivated by the IHR. We thought their disclosure obligations, perhaps that should be sufficient to comply, to generate compliance. But as it turns out, the IHR doesn't have very serious penalties for non-compliance when you don't report. So maybe there's a moral obligation represented by the legal obligation, but beyond that, I'm a little skeptical about the enforcement. To empirically test that is a little bit difficult. It was a one-time occurrence. You'd have to have some sense of what people would have done but for the regulations, and that's hard to come up with. So we really can't test it. I do think that we want to think about perhaps enhancing some of the sanctions. If you had sanctions for non-reporting, you could actually increase the incentives for people to report. If they don't, it's just like those non-reporting sanctions, except they would suffer the legal sanction of failing to report. So I think that that's an important part of the problem, but I have to say I'm a little skeptical that it's doing much now. I just don't think it's very well enforced.
Okay. I guess that brings us to the close of CDEP's very first seminar on the economics of pandemics. Thank you all for being here, and look forward to seeing your future events. Thank you.